the expression from the music inspired me so much to take risks, and it inspired damn near the whole rap game.
Hello again, I'm Adam Ons. You may know me as the host of The Opus, and now I'm bringing my own show, The Spark Parade, to the Consequence Podcast Network. I speak with artists and creatives about the cultural artifacts that spark their personal interest and creativity, whether it's music, books, movies, video games, or any other kind of art.
I've never spoke about it in this amount of detail. I'm suddenly going, oh my God, I'm blowing my own mind here, Christ. It's actually a giant part of my life.
By talking about the things we love, we share and discover insights into our personality and the things that drive us.
It's just magic, really. I mean, frustrating. And it makes some people angry, but I don't think anyone's ever done anything like it.
I speak with people like Connor Roberts, Phoenix's Thomas Mars, Chris Gethard, Helen Hong, Adrian Young, and more, so their sparks of inspiration can start a fire in you.
I'm grateful for those who continue to put our history and who we are as a people in the forefront and make you see it.
Find the Spark Parade wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
The UK ska punk scene has had a lot of interesting bands over the past two decades, and Daniel Pook, or just Pook, has played in a number of them, though he really found his voice in Beat the Red Light, where he mixed ska with elements of extreme metal. He's also recently started Pook Out Records, which began in 2019 as a distro to bring US albums to the UK, but he's since released some of his own albums by artists like Andy B in the World and Rochambeau.
I've known Pook for a really long time. I think the first time I met Pook was 2004.
Oh, wow. So this is like going back to the Dessa days?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, because of social media, we've been able to stay in touch ever since. And when I needed horns for the first Omnigon record, Pook was one of the first people I hit up.
Nice. I think one of the fun things about talking with him this time is because not only was he part of this UK ska punk scene in the mid-2000s, he stayed active, so we were able to cover a lot of ground. We were able to talk about how the UK ska punk scene has evolved and changed over the years from kind of its height of that period to the present.
The thing also with Pook is, in addition to his new band, Redemon, he was also in Beat the Red Light, and then ended up a member of Lightyear.
Oh, yes.
And then I also, like, didn't even realize that he was also in the Filaments. I was actually talking to him online one day. I was like, wait, you're in the Filaments? He was like, hi. Yes.
Why don't you tell us all the bands you are in and have been in, if you can remember them all.
Wow.
Now, also, I would like to say, before you begin, consider that all the people that will be upset if you forget their band name.
Well, oh my God, the pressure. The pressure, you know what? I was really nervous. If I wasn't nervous before, I am now. I don't want to let anyone down now. So, I think the very, very first band I was in was a band at school. Mm. Secondary school, so I'm guessing that's your high school, and we were called Stagnate, but that was N with a number 8.
Mm. Oh, okay.
Yeah, very punk rock that. That was we had one song, and we played the school talent show.
How did you do?
We We were awful. I'm not gonna lie.
What did you play in that band?
I played bass guitar. We opened up with the classic of Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Of course.
And I was playing bass guitar and vocals very badly with my school friends Tom Erica and Mike Lee. We had a couple of our own. I say a couple, we had like one, maybe two of our own songs, and that was pretty much it. We slowly, the three of us, like added more and more members and just actually turned into what would have been our first ska band, I guess, ska punk band called Punch Bowl.
Punch Bowl.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's some videos up on the old YouTube and I think maybe even Bandcamp and stuff like that. But yeah, it's all up on there.
What years are we talking?
Ooh, so Punch Bowl probably started in 2000. We started off as a four piece. So I was like 16. It was a three guys, Stagnate, Mike Lee, Tom Erica, and I, and then a guy that lived down the road from me called Dave Wood, and we basically, he played guitar and sax, and Tom, after going to a couple of Mad Caddy shows, decided to pick up trombone as well as guitar, so we would alternate, so one person would play guitar and Dave would play sax, and then it would turn the other way around. Dave would play guitar and Tom would play trombone, and we kind of worked it that way. But then gradually, as more members left, we just got more and more members. By the time we split up, I think we were like a 10-piece. it was pretty ridiculous, like trying to fit us on. We used to play a lot at this pub called the White Horse. I think actually Dessa played there, Adam. That was the first time I met you.
I think so, yeah.
And how we used to fit on that stage, I have no idea. I have no idea. I think there was times where it felt like there was more people on stage than the audience.
Always the sign of a good show.
Oh, God, yeah. Well, the sign of a good lineup.
So the band policy was anytime one member quit, you had to get two new members?
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. It was, yeah. Yeah, 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 absolutely. And even like when there was a couple of times like one of our trumpet players left, we were like, well, we've got to double up on the horns then. So we need more horns. So we just be like, yeah, I think we ended up with four of us as the back line and the rest of us were, it was like a five, six piece horn section. It was, it was pretty mad. So that was our first band. That was a lot of fun.
How good did that six piece horn section sound?
Do you know what? Actually, they towards the end
sounded pretty good. Everybody could play in tune.
Don't get me wrong. There were moments when you were like cringy. It's like, oh God, nothing sounds worse than brass clashing.
Oh yeah,
nothing sounds worse than that. But when it's together, it sounded good. They were only like, oh God, I think by this point we're probably like 18, 19. So probably, I don't know, old enough to have learned our instruments, but come on, it's a punk band, man.
Yeah, yeah.
we leave the decent horn sections to the bigger boys like Lynn Cade.
we kept it easy. We just had two. It was easy.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, less is more. Yeah. Less is definitely more sometimes. So, yeah, so we went from Punch Bowl and then, God, I'm trying to think. Then we had... there was a band after that where Bill from Punch Bowl and I started up another band called The Armistice. We probably played like four, maybe five shows. One of them was opening for Streetlight, which was awesome. Like that was amazing. That was like their first UK tour. We did an EP. We did like a DIY EP, you know, like the old slip case and the black and white Photoshop cover. We did all that, and then that actually gradually, that was when it started, like the demise of Armistice occurred, and then we started to venture out into what would have been Beat the Red Light.
So that first Streetlight tour in the UK, what kind of rooms, like what size audiences were they drawing?
Well, again, that would have been, I don't know, like they were playing the Camden Underworld as well as the White Horse. So you're probably looking at the starting point, you're probably looking at under 500 cap.
Mm-hmm.
Under 500 cap venue seeing Streetlight. It was amazing. And they were as tight then as they were now. Like that, those horn sections are just absolutely phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
Phenomenal. They were really, really hot. But yeah, like so we kind of went from that. And then it became apparent some of the guys in the Armistice didn't quite like the heavier aspect of what half of us wanted to go down. And they left and other people joined. And yeah, we just started off Beat the Red Light, and it just kind of went off from there, really.
And then what year did Beat the Red Light start? What year are we at now?
So that would have started 2007.
Okay.
I remember the first time I tried to explain to like Eddie, who's in Beat the Red Light, and he was also in the Armistice as well, what I kind of thought of what would envisioned as like proper heavy metal ska. I remember trying to explain it to Eddie and a few of the other guys, and they didn't quite grasp it. I remember having to do this. I went to my friend Mike, who was in Stagnate, and I used his. He's got like a little recording studio. I recorded Sending the Clowns, which was one of the songs on that first EP, sending it to them. And soon as he kind of got it from there, it all spanned it out. So, yeah, we started Beat the Red Light in 2007, and getting that lineup was a bit of a struggle. I must admit, we had I suppose you got, for you guys, like in America, it's probably not a lot. Like for the UK, if you're traveling over an hour, that seems forever.
Yeah,
actually, in the UK, that seems forever. But like states wise, I'm assuming for you guys, it's like anything under like what am I right to say like five hours is seems like a reasonable journey or
well being in California, like just to drive to Southern California is basically the same as driving from like the top of England to the bottom of England. Like when you come from California and tour in the UK, like none of the drives feel long.
That's nuts.
You're just like, oh, this is great. And the weird thing too is kids will like take the train to shows.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so you see kids at the same shows like on a run, like for like four shows in a row. Or at least you did back then, because it was just like,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
The same kids would keep turning up, and they're just like, oh yeah, just hop on the train. Like it's not a big deal.
I mean, I've never toured in the East Coast, but the East Coast is a little similar, right? I mean, if you're
East Coast is similar to UK, where it's like you drive for an hour and you cross like three or four state lines.
That's crazy.
But yeah, West Coast here. I mean, it's like not just California. It's like,
oh yeah, the whole West Coast, all the way out to like the Midwest.
Yeah,
like it's all long drives.
That's nuts. But yeah, we had our initial guitarist in Beat the Red Light, Jonna. He lived in a city called Ipswich, which is like 2 hours away. So for us, we're like, oh my god, that's forever. That's some serious dedication. Like coming once a week to band practice to do that and do a gig. And he's like, I think I'm gonna have to move here, guys. Like it's getting a bit of a it's a bit of a commute for me, but it's okay. So hearing you guys say that, it's been like, oh, okay, maybe it's not that far.
I mean, 2 hours to a band practice, and so that's 4 hours round trip. That's a commitment for sure.
Yeah.
Adam, though, what's the farthest away you lived from the rest of Link 80 during the run? Wasn't there a period of time where you lived really far away from them?
I mean, I lived in Sacramento and Gilroy during that time period. So each way is like, that's at least an hour and a half each way.
Uh-huh.
Not quite as bad. Barry lives a little bit. Barry lived a little bit deeper out in the Central Valley, so I think his commute could be, especially if you hit traffic, it could be 1 hour 45 to 2 hours.
That's crazy. It just seems weird for me. For me, it's like I think in the UK, where there's bands, wherever they're based, it's like they everyone lives within this town, and this town is like, if you've got to travel more than 30 minutes to get to band practice, well, forget it.
Yeah,
it's not gonna happen. It's like herding kittens when it gets like that.
When your guitar player moved, did you all move somewhere together, or did...
No. He moved to Wickham.
Okay.
He moved to the mothership.
Okay.
So yeah. So we did that, and I was like, right, okay. So we're gonna have to start taking this seriously, and then yeah, like it was phenomenal because his background is. Like the first time I met Jonnet, he was in like a I suppose kind of skate speed punk band, a bit like kind of like the kind of skate punky snuff kind of fat wreck sounding bands. But he was actually into like his bread and butter was actually like black metal, like stuff like Dimmu Borgir and Cradle of Filth. But he loved ska as well. Which for me was like, right, you know what it's, you'll get this, you'll be well into this. So yeah, like writing with him was just absolutely phenomenal. So we went to recording an EP. We did that all live, actually. We got, Adam, you might be able to clarify this for me. Hmm. RX Bandit's Resignation, they recorded that all live, right?
I think so. I think Battle Begun also. Probably everything from that period forward they recorded live.
Yeah.
And I think with Battle Begun they tried to do it all in one take.
Oh my god.
And then I think there's like a spot right in the middle where there's like a fuck up and they leave it in.
Oh really?
Like a song starts and then you hear one of them like yell like fuck, and then they
start the song over again.
And I think that's the only edit on the album for the rhythm section.
Jeez.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So yeah, anyway, we took massive inspiration from that. And decided to record that EP live. And I think those kind of recordings, like they give you a vibe. They definitely give you there's definitely a vibe when you listen to it, like there's an atmosphere to it, to the recording. So we definitely took massive inspiration on that. But then we had we recorded Salt the Lands as well, and that was that was a nightmare. We basically, like I said, trying to get eight people together is like herding kittens, and we'd all booked this time off to the studio, and the studio cancelled on us the night before our first day there, so we had to basically engineer, record, and find the locations to record it all within like an evening. It was pretty nuts, but I was pretty stoked on what the outcome of it was.
Where did you end up recording it?
So we were going to record in the studio in the outskirts of High Wycombe, where we're all living and from, but we ended up using a rehearsal space back in Ipswich, where we emptied out. They had the whole rehearsal space was just completely empty. No one was hiring it at all that week, so we hired it for that week. And yeah, we just recorded it all there. And our other second guitarist, Mike, he basically took on the job of engineering and recording it, all at the last minute. And I'm not gonna lie, like the pressure was on for him, but he knocked out in the park. I thought.
Do you know why the original studio canceled on you last second?
Yeah, our bass player was in a band with a guy who worked there, and basically he I don't quite know the ins and outs of why it got canceled, but he ran off with a lot of money. Not our money, but he ran off with a lot of money. He was in a lot of debt and upset a lot of people. And yeah, he's still to this day never been around or seen in Wickham since. I think he grabbed a load of gear and just went off with it. But we had band rehearsal there, and we obviously the night before finished at like, I think it was like a 3 till 6 practice. We're just like making sure everything was all good to go. And then we said to the guy who was there, we're like, are you all right if we just leave our gear here? Because we're coming in tomorrow. He was like, you are? I was like, yeah. We're down for recording here. And he was like, no, you're not. And I was like, yeah. We spoke to Mark, and he said he's booked us all in and everything. And he was like, no, you're not booked in. And he tried to ring Mark. No answer. We tried to call this guy. No answer. And then lo and behold, he disappeared. Like, our bass player G went to his flat, and he wasn't there. His family wasn't there. They'd all gone. did a great Houdini and just disappeared.
And no one's seen him since.
No. Not as far as I'm aware.
Wow.
But it'd be interesting if some of us did see him.
Hey, it might have to have some words.
Yeah. something like that.
Yeah.
The horn boys, the brass boys are going to come along and have a little word with you.
Yeah.
No, it's no one's seen or heard from him since. I don't know whether it's probably, I don't know, drug related or something like that. But yeah, he ended up upsetting a lot of people. So. But I mean, at the end of the day, I think what the cards we got dealt with, I think what we came out with was something probably a bit more special because of what Mother Nature threw at us. I think it makes that album a little bit more extra special to us than like suppose the EP where just we turned up at a studio and it all went really smoothly. It was like, yeah, there was a lot of blood, sweat and tears on that. Like I remember literally like Mike trying to create a vocal booth after we did the recording in Ipswich. We did the vocals in his bedroom in Wickham, and it's a terraced house, so me trying to shout in a terraced house could probably upset a lot of neighbors. So we tried to make this we got like 3 or 4 like mattresses to try and make this vocal booth, and it was just like, yeah, some of the stories just trying to make it all was just absolutely priceless.
How was it screaming in a booth that's like basically an insulated room? Probably got pretty warm real quick.
Oh yeah, it got toasty. It got toasty and warm. There was beads of sweat. It was good. It was good. It took a lot of adjusting and getting used to, as opposed to like when you know you're in a studio and you know everything's properly soundproof and you can really let yourself go, as opposed to right, it's just forget about the neighbors for a sec, just get this done.
Yeah,
half an hour burst and yeah, it's fine.
Did anyone call and check in on you guys?
No, not on that, but on other recordings, yeah. on other recordings, yeah, definitely. There's been times, is he all right? Someone beating someone up? What's going on? Yeah, like this, the classic dong of a frying pan or something. It's happened a couple of times, but no, not on that recording.
Yeah.
We'll be right back after this.
This is probably a dumb question, but you said you recorded in a terrorist house?
No. It was our guitarist's house.
Oh, your guitarist's house. I'm sorry.
A terrorist house? God, that would have been a story.
No, it sounded like you said terrorist's house, like it was like stacked or something.
Oh, right. Oh, okay, yeah. Sorry. A terrorist house. Yeah, that's right. A terrorist house.
No, but.
So I thought you said. We just hooked up with ISIS. Hey man,
yeah, I mean,
who's they know, your studio,
they know how to make media, so
that's it. We
like, you want to use our mics?
Yeah, that's it. Can we do you mind if you just couple of shares on your Facebook page, like what's up with that?
Okay, so Salt the Land, how was that received?
Do you know what? I think it was weird because I think we were all really stoked with how hard it was, like with the troubles that we were given and like the obstacles that came in our way, and how we were so stoked that we actually finished it and got it done. I think it was, we were really like, wow, this is gonna like change a couple, like turn a couple of heads and whatnot. But I think the time where we really thought, yeah man, like we've kind of found our sound, was I think it was probably a week after we finished recording. We played a show at another venue in High Wycombe called the Nag's Head, and we played with, I think it was Random Hands and the JB Conspiracy and a couple of others, and we played that album from front to back, and no one had heard that had heard the songs at all apart from us. And it was amazing to see like the look on everyone's face, just like, oh my god, because I think there were still bands doing that, but I just think at that point, when you're trying to do that in 2007, when Scar in the UK like had died probably in about, it picked up a bit in, it got really big in like 2000, but I think by the time 2005 came along, I think it was dwindling and everyone was like hitting the emo scene then in the UK. So it was like really I don't know, I think people were surprised about, we were taking this genre of music that had a like a always really quirky and goofy kind of thing, and actually trying to make it just a bit more serious. And yeah, just a bit darker, like give it a darker element as well. So I mean, like the EP for me personally was great, but that was not really a ska metal release, as opposed to like Salt the Lands, which is a ska metal release, or a Metallica release, as some people like to quote it.
You were saying earlier that it was kind of your vision, though, to mix these elements.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like I listened to, like, I freaking love ska, but I also love so many different styles, man. Like I like some of my favorite bands are like Lamb of God, Sepultura, Cradle of Filth, like some really heavy bands. And I wanted to see what it would, I don't know, like in my head, I really wanted to try and push the boundaries on that a little bit. There's definitely like heavy ska core bands around, but I really wanted to go for that metallic edge to it. Really like fast syncopated like horn lines, where if you were to play that, if you weren't playing that riff on a horn, you were playing it on a guitar, it could basically be a heavy metal riff.
Mm-hmm.
That was the kind of thing that I had thought of and whatnot, and it was amazing the fact that having people like Jonna, Eddie and Mike come on board, and Tim, and actually put their own stamp on it as well, and actually to become a whole unit team piece and whatnot. So yeah, definitely.
Yeah, you know, listening to your music and hearing how you blend these styles and, you know, kind of go from one to another, it's pretty amazing, because you really don't think of these two styles as mixing. Is there a moment or a specific song, you know, you had this vision and then you finally put it together in a specific song, and you were able to say like, oh, I'm actually making these work, and it doesn't sound like I'm taking oil and water and trying to force it to work?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was, like I said, the first time I recorded Send in the Clowns, because no one was trying to, everyone was almost just laughing at me to a degree. Like, what are you? What are you talking about? Like, you want like beat downs and like heavy metal, and you want that with like clown circus ska music? Like, what do you want? And it was for me to actually have that CD and listen to it, I was like, oh my god, like, yes, this does actually work. and stepping it up more and more and more. I've always kind of found like if there's when writing a song, if it feels forced, you just shouldn't write it. Like there's a reason why it should be like you just shouldn't force something. It should just happen kind of naturally. And I just kind of felt like, yeah, but at that point when I was recording Sending the Clowns, especially hearing the kind of there's almost kind of like a middle eight bit with like these horror horn lines, like the kind of like these really weird, like building up tension to like drop into like to this beat down. For me, it was just like, it just makes total sense. It just makes absolute total sense. And the thing is, it's what I found really fascinating was, I think it was about 2008, 2009, there was a three-way split. I can't remember the third name, the third band. One of them was a band called Kickback UK, but one of the bands on it was The Best of the Worst. And it was the first time I heard them, and I was like, they've got it. They know what it's about. They've definitely are on the same path of us, kind of thing. Which was it was really, really lovely to hear that. Hear another band go that way as well. And it was interesting as well by the fact that I'd never heard of this band and this band had never heard of us, yet we were both other sides of the pond, just kind of doing our own thing together. I thought like creating like a very similar sound, as you say. So I don't think there was ever really a point where I really kind of went, oh, I don't know if this is going to work or anything like that.
But there was a moment where you, like when you demoed Sending the Clowns, you saw, you could hear it working, like your brain envisioned it.
I mean, I had it in my head, and it was, I'm awful at like, pretty easy as you can hear right now, I'm not the best at like explaining stuff to a degree. I'm just like, yeah, we want this metal bit here, and then it's going to be like, a ska verse, and then it's going to be like a metal chorus, and I don't get it. And I'm just like, right, I'm going to play you this riff, and then it's going to go into this ska bit and this riff, and all of a sudden, he's just like, dude, I have no idea what you're talking about. In the end, that was when I was just like, look, I'm going to make a little demo, show it to you. It will all make sense then. Because I think the other thing we were, a lot of what people wouldn't quite understand is where you've got, it's quite intricate in the sense of where you have kind of a really intricate thrashy guitar part, but then you've got a different horn melody on top. And there's also that where you're trying to find the balance of, for the listener, of, okay, what am I listening to? Am I listening to the horn line? Am I listening to the guitar line? Or am I just listening to the whole thing as one whole piece, per se? And I think that is where a lot of people, initially from the Armistice into Beat the Red Light, didn't quite get what I was going for regarding with sounds of that. But they got it in the end, and that's all that matters.
So what was your thoughts behind it? Was it about creating a like a sound where everything blends together and you're just taking it in? Or did you feel like you were focusing on, you wanted people to focus on different parts, at different parts of the song?
I wanted to take the listener on a journey. Where they didn't know what to expect next. Mm-hmm. If you know what I mean. It takes, for me, some of my favorite albums are the ones that I didn't get first time. Mm-hmm. I'll listen to it. If I get an album first time, I'm just like, okay, that was good. Then after the second, third listen, I just get a bit, not bored of it, but I'm like, okay, I'll go and listen to something else. But if I didn't quite get it the first listen, but there's something that kind of grabs me on it, then and eventually I get more and more into it, and then before I know it, it's like, yeah, one of my favorite albums. Like I'm trying to think, like Hot Stove Jimmy, Theme for a Major Hit, was a big one for me. Like I was like, wow, this sounds like Jesus Lizard, like Nirvana in Utero, some Steve Albini stuff, but gone ska. Like who does that? Like it's really, 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 really bizarre sounding, and it just took a few listens to work out like where it was going and what it was doing and what part was coming next. And I just find it more just really fascinating and interesting.
So you mentioned a little bit ago that some of your later recording sessions, people were concerned, neighbors, and they called or they checked in on you.
Oh yeah, when doing vocals.
Let's hear about this.
So this was actually quite recent. We were I was doing the vocals for the Redeemer release, and we made the choice. Like Alad, our guitarist, has recorded it, took on recording duties, and he's got a studio in his living room. It's got all the gear there, but we didn't have a mic booth, should we say. So I was just doing it. Basically, everyone who was in the room just had to keep quiet while I was doing it there. And there was the this couple from downstairs. Basically, they ended up knocking on the door upstairs because Alad lives there with his girlfriend Becky, and they knocked on the door to make sure that everything was okay. And that was the time where we were just like, maybe we should find a studio to do this, because we were doing it on a shoestring budget, like, because the Redeemer recording was like, we'd spent like five six years trying to make this recording happen one way or another. So we were trying to, towards the end of it, we were just trying to do it on a not a budget, but just trying to save money when we could. And we ended up upsetting Alan's neighbors.
Yeah, recording loud screamy vocals like in a residential area is so stressful.
I mean, it must be worse doing it in a van or something, Adam. I mean, I don't know what...
The van was great. Doing it with Van Tana Row was awesome because we would just meet at a parking lot somewhere.
That's what I mean. It's like, imagine just walking past you're just in a car park. You hear this muffled...
I mean, the van already looks totally crazy, so nobody's parking near that van.
It's just these screeching tires. It burns off into the sunset. Yeah. You like duct taped up.
Yeah. And that was actually one of my favorite ways to record vocals. I highly recommend doing it in a van.
Doing it in a van in a car park.
Yeah, in a van in a car park. You just park at the far side of the parking lot and and then if you have to go to the bathroom, you just walk into the grocery store.
That's it.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Buy yourself a snack while you're in there.
But lessons were definitely learned from there.
Yeah.
Don't do vocals then. And even now, like, there's been times where I've done the odd bit of like demo vocal takes now, and before I even do it now, I always give the neighbors a heads up, kids. If you hear someone shouting, no one's having an argument. It's me doing vocals. It's me trying to sing. I'm like, I know. Especially when you're trying to do like the death metal pig squeals. Oh God.
Yeah, I when I try to record things at home now, I try to like make sure I know exactly what I'm about to do, get everything set up.
Yeah.
And then I try to keep it to like 15 minutes tops. Like get it banged out as quick as possible, just so that the neighbors aren't...
Bust your vocals, man.
That too, you also don't want to, totally wreck your voice.
No.
But my neighbors, the house next to us is right there, and they're in their side yard a lot, so I always worry, yelling something in here, they're gonna be like, oh, what's happening? Oh gosh.
Yeah, I mean, I can't do it. It's probably been even worse now since COVID, and everyone had to kind of like come to a bit of a standstill.
Yeah. But
I remember like the Beat the Red Light days, my technique, like I'd give myself a headache. I genuinely would give myself a headache from like straining too hard because I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah.
But just towards the end of that and the start of Redeeming, like I had it dialed down. Like I kind of learned to use your diaphragm, your stomach, and then I had a voice of leather. But then after that, it's just, yeah, now it's just, I don't know, I do about 10-15 minutes, it's just more like it's like a little squeak as opposed to like this guttural death shout. But I mean, even Redeeming, it's kind of, we've gone a bit more melodic with that as opposed to Beat the Red Light anyway. So yeah.
The headache from screaming is always disconcerting.
Oh, it's the worst.
I always feel like I'm about to like have an aneurysm or something.
It hurts like the I don't know, like it started to hurt like the bottom of my back.
Oh wow.
Like there's going to be all these vocalists just like rolling their eyes going, "Oh my god, what's he doing?
Yeah.
Like, how is he hurting himself like this?" I don't know. It's punk rock, isn't it?
Is there warm-up techniques?
Do you know what? At first there was never, but then who was it? Someone introduced me that there was like a YouTube technique video. And it was like warm-ups. And yeah, I do that for about 10 minutes and that is pretty much it.
Is it singing warm-ups or is it warm-up specific to screaming?
Yeah, it's warm-up specific specifics for screaming. And
really? What's a screaming warm-up like?
Yeah, you should send this video to me, Pook.
Yeah? Yeah?
I have singing warm-ups, like, but I don't know how much they help with screaming. I mean, it helps a little bit. You at least get your voice warmed up, but.
Yeah, just kind of give us a brief explanation of how one scream warm-ups.
Oh, God. Right. Well, the one that I can remember was, it was called Big Face, Little Face. So, right? I can't believe I'm on a podcast saying this. Right. So, right, I tell you what, I'm gonna tell you. You guys are, I can't see you, but you guys have got to try this. You've got to really squish up your face. So like really close your eyes and smush in your lips and do all that. And then all of a sudden you need to release and open your eyes and your mouth as wide as you can. And it was like Big Face, Little Face. You have to do that for like, Big Face is like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, Little Face 1, 2, 3, and you're like warming up, you're stretching your face to do it. That's like one example.
Wow. Okay.
So that was one of them. Then I'm trying to remember what there was. Oh god, do you know what, like the more of these I'm thinking, I'm just like, oh, they've probably just been mugging me off with this video and just watching me in the background just doing it's going, what is this idiot doing?
Look, he's doing the warm-ups, he thinks they're working.
Quick, someone get the camera. He's doing Big Face, Little Face again.
Can you think of any other?
There was one where you were, oh god, do you know what, it's because it's been so long, it's been like a couple of years since I've done it now, but there was one where you were using the back of your throat going like you're gradually getting louder and louder and louder. Oh, I'm trying to think what else there was. There was a fair few little exercises on it, and it made you look absolutely crazy and bonkers, but it did work.
Nice.
Yeah. You can scream longer and louder.
Yeah.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
Once Beat the Red Light got out there, people heard you, people saw you live, they heard the records. Were you getting any interest from metal fans who maybe otherwise weren't that into ska?
Do you know what? Like, yeah, we, it was so bizarre because for us, the DIY punk scene in the UK is so much stronger than any other music scene in the UK. As far as I'm concerned. So with that in mind, you just get so much more support from that scene. So when you're playing like a heavy metal show, like we put on a night with a band called Almeida and another band called Divine Chaos. Divine Chaos are getting really, if you're into heavy metal, definitely should check those guys out. And we played with them, and it was really bizarre, because it was, the thing I found interesting is they'd have one look at us warming up the brass and they'd be like, oh
yeah,
oh god, what are we in for? And then yeah, we'd basically start off with like a 30-second grindcore song with it, and it would kind of turn them around. But yeah, it never. I think we got a few. We never got mocked for it. Let's put it that way. It was heavy metal. The heavy metal scene, I find, is very much there. It's not cool to show emotion or feeling. So if you're not getting mocked, you're clearly doing something good. That's the way I kind of saw it as. I think there was definitely points that we had a few people turn around going like, holy moly, I was not expecting like that, you guys to be playing that. I was expecting like real big fish, Hawaiian shirt, pork pie hat, cheesy scar, and then getting that. It's like, well, dude, like there's more to Scar than just like what everyone seems to think that Scar is, which is just cheesy, goofy, badly dressed Hawaiian shirt skanking. Like there's more to it than that. So yeah, and I think after a while it was we slowly did see, especially towards the end of it, there was certainly a lot more sort of mop haired looking, bullet belt wearing battle vest jackets out. It was quite a nice surprise actually towards the end of it with that.
Nice.
Definitely. And I think that was the great thing about playing that style of music is, theoretically, you can easily worm your way. Like we've got Redeemer have got like a show coming up, and we're playing with literally, the only way I could describe it is like a load of Ronnie James Dio type bands, like it Skid Row, like get your spandex on. It's literally like all those bands, and then there's us. So that's going to be a real interesting one.
You're not even playing their style of metal, let alone adding ska.
Oh god, yeah. No, there is a part of me that wants to like really holy diver it. Get an air fist it while going for it. Yeah, while bringing out the trombone. Maybe get some pyrotechnics, get some flamethrowers coming out.
Oh, just don't catch your hair on fire.
Well, that's a bit too late on that, mate, being ginge.
So conversely, like the ska scene, like my experience with the ska scene, at least here in the US, is that, you know, everyone has their own individual taste and everything, but generally speaking, most ska fans are accepting of a band taking the music in a totally unique direction and mixing elements that hadn't been mixed in it before, and they don't like, then they're usually interested in it, like, oh, that's different, let's hear more.
A lot more open-minded.
Yeah.
A lot more open-minded. Yeah, definitely. And that's amazing, because I think there's so many other genres where they're literally like, I'll only listen to heavy metal and heavy metal only, and everything else is rubbish. And it's like, come on, mate. Like, there's more to it than that. Surely. Like, mm-hmm. so many different colours out there, man. You just gotta play with it, mix and match and see what works. Like there was one of the, I remember going back to, actually, this involves you a little bit, Adam. So
let's hear it.
So I was at college, and one of my friends called Chris was a metalhead. Like if it wasn't Max Cavalera, forget it. and there was some, there was elements of him, he liked the odd bit of ska, like he was, oh, it's all right. But anything with a horn in, he was like, nah, hates it. So I played him the beginning of The Struggle Continues. So it's got this full-blown, like, obviously, this kind of doomy intro, and he's nodding. I'm like, this is Scar, mate. You're loving it. Then he just heard the horns go, banana, and he literally just threw the headphones off, looked at me, shook his head, and just walked down. He wouldn't speak to me for 3 days. But it's that kind of, like, I love it. We still laugh about it now, but it's that kind of mentality. You're just, oh, it's just unbelievable. Can't, like, yeah. So going back to, like, the heavy metal scene and whatnot, it's there's some open-minded people out there, but yeah,
some aren't. I feel like using horns in that way, like, I don't understand why more bands, like some of these even just straight up just metal bands who have, like, you know, symphonic arrangements, why not have a horn section that's doing that sort of thing? It doesn't have to be all, like, you know, goofy, happy sounding. Like, you can use it to affect.
Yeah, like I 100% agree. Like, you can't say, like your old band Voodoo. I could kind of see people going, oh, it's a bit clowny, but like, but it's not. It's like maniac-y, like kind of Blue Meanies.
Yeah,
it's very frantic at the same point. It's not the instrument, it's what you do with it. And I just find it such a shame when people really limit themselves to just one style of playing and one style of music and one genre.
Let's change gears a little bit. So you played in Lightyear for a little while.
I was waiting for this. Yeah,
little. You know, we love to talk about Lightyear.
Do I need to ask a question, or
what Lightyear stories?
Yeah, okay. You know where we're going.
Yeah, no, so basically it started back 2019. I got asked by Chaz to fill in on the Real Big Fish tour. It was Real Big Fish, Sponge and Lightyear. I've known Chaz for years, absolute sweetheart, and it was basically an offer I just could not refuse. And then since then, Lightyear have done like the odd show here and there, and then they've just asked me to jump on when needs be, and I wouldn't say I'm a member, but there's been I've filled in and play for them a lot. But
let me just jump in real quick. How I remember them back in the day, completely unhinged. how have they aged? Like, I feel like they've pulled back slightly, but not really.
I okay. I think he has. I think they have. I think they've I've had like some really great chats with them about it. And just like I looking back, and he was like, yeah, half the stuff that they did, there's no way they could get away with doing that now.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like some of them have got, like, they've got families, they've grown up.
Yeah.
There's social media. Like, do you know what I mean? Like like back in the day, they got away with murder. But one of the things I found, like, so obviously there's the whole nudity thing, and looking, I had a really lovely chat with Chaz and Neil one time a few years back about it, and they were like, well, it's a bit like just sticking the two fingers up at the bullies. Like, they were, those guys were like, as we all kind of were, like being brass horn players and stuff like that, you kind of get a bit bullied at school, and there was points where you kind of, they're not they can knock you down, and you feel like, I don't know, like you you don't have any value in yourself and whatnot. And Chaz and Neil, from what I could work out back then, when they were like running around naked, it was them almost making stars. Like, this is who we are. And if you don't like us, then you can do one kind of thing. Am I allowed to swear on this? I don't know if I'm allowed.
Yeah, please.
Yeah. They basically, you can fuck off. If you don't like it, fuck off. But I think with doing that to the ska punk community, where everyone else has been like, not say everyone, but a lot of people there have been bullied for listening to a certain genre of music and whatnot, it's like, yeah, freaking proud of listening to ska, and this is what we're into, and this is our family, and so be it. And I don't know if that works really with the Gigi Allen side of things, however. But yeah, with the nudity and stuff like that, I think it was a bit of a F you from there. But Chaz and Neil, oh my God, like, I'm trying to think of a story that's not gonna be too okay. Here's one. So
all right.
Okay. So I'm in Brighton. This is before I'm in the Filaments, which is another band I'm in. Before I was in the Filaments, it was like a household name bash thing going on. There was Filaments played, Lightyear, Cap Down, I think it was Five Knuckle as well, all playing in Brighton. And I was chatting to the old Filaments bass player, John, just chat to them, and then chat to John, and all of a sudden the stage manager went up to John and said, "Have you seen the Lightyear guys?" We were like, "Well, no." So we had to go searching for them, and we searched the venue, nowhere to be found. We thought, "Oh, we're going to go and check their van." As we approached the van, you could hear this muffled giggling. So we slowly walked towards this thing. We're like, oh, God, what are we going to walk into? So basically what they'd done is that we'd opened the door and we saw Chaz and Neil with Jim's drumsticks sticking them up each other's butt. Just giggling away, and Jim had no idea because he had to play with those sticks. It's like literally we opened this door and we were just like, oh holy shit, and it just shut the door like, oh, you're on in five, mate, we're on in five. Just left them to it. But that's one of the many.
Did they make it on stage in time?
Oh god, yeah. Yeah, they were
very professional.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know about professional. I know Tarpaulin was involved in that actual show.
They were prompt.
Yeah, they were prompt. But yeah, I remember in the middle of Blindside, they got they had a picnic in the middle of Blindside and got the Tarpaulin out. That was pretty. That was pretty special. There was a lot of people crying in the audience.
Yeah, they would bring out a whole table and set it and have a meal, right? And like read the paper.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I love that.
And then Neil would wash his hands in urine and his face. And the people who weren't jaw dropped in shock were probably like heaving.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty gnarly. But I remember seeing them the next day. As they entered into the Punker Bunker, there was a lot of hungover faces, a lot of sorry faces. But I gotta admit, like, I still remember that show.
Yeah,
might not be for the right reasons, but I remember that show. it was a blinder.
And then the Filaments, how does that line up with Beat the Red Light?
So basically, oh god, so. I joined the Filaments probably about 12 years ago. I joined them about 12 years ago. And it was literally Ian and Pete, their old trumpet and sax player, left for different reasons, like traveling and getting like settling down and stuff like that. And then they needed a horn player. So I went in with that. And I managed to do them both at the same time. Like Filaments only really kind of play like a small handful of shows. Like a lot of them would be in like mainland Europe, and you just kind of juggle a lot of them. And to be fair, like a lot of the ska shows in the UK, like both bands would be playing together. So it wasn't really that much of an issue juggling the two bands. It made it lovely having Eddie join the band as well. So when Eddie was in Beat the Red Light, and I managed to talk them into expanding the horn section. Then we managed to get Eddie on board with that. It just made it, having two of the bands, two of the members from Beat the Red Light to join Filaments, it just made life a lot easier once that happened, juggling both the bands. But it was fine. And then if one band had a show and the other band was like, hey, can we jump on, it made it nice and easy. So it was good like that.
Definitely. And then I saw footage from the most recent Filaments show.
Oh, well, the Random Hand one.
Yeah, was Joe from Random Hand playing bass? Is he in that band?
No, that's Smithy. No, that's Adam Smith.
They look really similar.
Do they?
I think so.
All right, I'll put the two of them together and see what they...
Yeah, put them together so I can see. I need a picture of both of them together.
Okay. Yeah, but Ian, the trumpet player, he's came back now, which is awesome. So he's back to having like a big three-piece horn section.
Oh, nice.
But yeah, I think it's how it should sound, man. Like when it was just me doing trombone for the Filaments, it sounded all right, but it just, to me, a trombone on its own doing that when it was initially meant to be like a three-piece horn section, it just doesn't fill the gap on it for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't believe how quick it's gone being in that band.
I want to jump back real quick. Lightyear, you guys, you're in the band and you open for Real Big Fish, and Sponge also were on the tour. Is that what you said?
Yeah, man, that was the best.
Okay, so 2019. Who plays? Who's first and who's supporting on that tour?
We swapped it.
Okay.
Each show we swapped it. So first day. The first day was Oxford, Sponge opened. Then the next day we opened. Yeah, we just alternated through that, which made it so much easier, man. And it's just so, like, I don't know, like nobody when bands get to a certain status, no band really wants to open. Do you know what I mean? But
yeah,
someone's got to, sadly, and it's just the easy answer, really, isn't it? Everyone's happy that way, as long as like the home, whichever one's closest to your home. Like you're like the main support, then it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
We just decided to swap it that way and just keep it like that. But yeah, that was like the best 2 weeks ever. I didn't want to come back home. I really didn't want to come back home from that.
During that 2 weeks, what happened to Neil's feet?
Oh God! Right, Neil is an amazing human being, but he is stubborn as a mule. he's basically been away from Lightyear doing like a scuba diving instructor, and he was living over on like an island on the like off Thailand, I think it was.
Yeah.
And on his like the last day where he was coming back home, he was playing football, but he played bare feet and his feet got infected. And he decided he was going to see someone when he came back. And then he got back and he just, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. It will sort itself out. As long as I keep it clean and clear. Well, the problem is, though, he wasn't keeping it clean. It was like he was wearing flip-flops, but like walking through puddles and things like that. So it just got infected, bless him. And it got to, I think it might be Birmingham. I think it was Birmingham, where he was just in absolute, he just couldn't walk on them anymore. And yeah, we just basically, we had to take it to the hospital, and they just said, yeah, you need to, this, if you don't get this resolved now, this is going to get septic. Like, it was that bad. We literally, we had to then work out what we were going to do. Were we going to carry on with the tour or not? And then we decided, like, we'd got this far and we could do it. We were going to try one show without him and see if it would work with just the two horns. And then Calvin, who's playing bass on that tour, and I were going to cover, like, he was going to take half of Neil's lyrics and I was going to take the other half. And it, do you know what? Like, it worked out all right. We managed to pull it off. It was missed though. Like, his stage presence is phenomenal.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a bit touching cloth, should I say. So in the end, he had to go back home, which was just really gutting, because he's never missed a Lightyear show. He's never, ever, ever missed a Lightyear show. So that was really, really hard for him.
I'm really curious. So 2019, what size room are Real Big Fish playing in the UK in 2019?
So they were like Academy. So you're talking, some of them varied. You're talking at 1,500. London, we played Islington Academy. That was like 1,000, but we did 2 days there. They pull a big crowd, man. They really do pull a big crowd, which is absolutely phenomenal. As well as bands like Less Than Jake as well, they'll pull huge, like probably the same as Real Big Fish. It's just a shame that, like, other bands don't pull that. Like, I'd love to see, like Big D and the Kids Table. I'd love to see them. They deserve it. Like, they've really worked hard on their craft and whatnot, and they should be, like, pulling that. And it's just a shame that people are literally just listen to Real Big Fish and Less Than Jake, and that's it. Not everyone, but you know what I mean. It's, they're the ones that pulled a big audience. But
I had heard that because Real Big Fish in the US, it was Sellout was the big song, and then Beer and Take On Me.
Yeah.
Is that, I had heard that the they got bigger a little later in the UK, and it was from different songs, or do I have it wrong?
Yeah, you know what? I don't know if it would be from different songs, but so you guys, like, the big ska, well, do we have to call it in waves? But let's
call it ska boom. We had a big ska boom here.
Yeah, the ska boom. So that for you guys was like early mid 90s?
Say 96 and then 97 were probably the two main years, yeah.
So, right, okay. For us, it kicked off 2000. It kicked off just that, it was that little slight gap. Mm-hmm. So I would say from 2000 to 2003-04, then it started to, like, dwindle down a little bit. But there was a point, like, early 2000 for me, I was always at the Underworld. Pretty much every weekend, I was at the Underworld, and it was a 500 cap venue, and it was, especially if it had like the Household Name logo on it, it always sold out. Mm-hmm. That or Moonsky Europe, it always sold out. But going back to the Real Big Fish aspect of it, I mean, what year was it that Basketball came out?
Like 97, maybe 98. Yeah. So by 2000, ska was considered a dead genre here, and all of those bands, they continued on, but they weren't on the radio anymore.
Yeah. No, it was just kicking off. It was just kicking off in like 2000s.
Yeah.
But I would have said it was the same songs though, the same Real Big Fish tracks.
So when at the shows, like in 2019, was it like everyone went crazy for the songs that I named, or was there other, is there other songs?
Yeah. Like every show that they played, it ended with Beer.
Okay.
Ended with Beer, and it always opened with Sellout.
Okay.
So yeah, they were the big ones. I'm trying to think what else. what other songs they may have had that was really, what was the one that was on the Real Big Fish track that was on that football game? That may have actually been Sell Out, I think.
I'm not sure. Do you know the football game, Adam?
What, like FIFA?
Yeah, it was. It was like a FIFA. I'm pretty sure actually it was. I'm pretty sure it was Sell Out.
Makes sense.
Yeah, but it was it was still the exact same songs, really. And they were just, the only way I could describe Real Big Fish live is like, it was just so tight. It was ridiculously tight. It was almost like where you've got one aspect of it, you've got Lightyear, where you have no idea what Chaz is going to do on stage. Like I made the mistake of telling Chaz that I was taking my P-bone, and it was made of plastic, and I was like, oh, it's virtually indestructible. It's made of fiberglass. And all he heard in his head, he was like, virtually indestructible, you say? every show, he was like, oh, Pook, let me have a look at your trombone. Mid-gig, this is, he would pick up my trombone and throw it into the audience, just launch it. there's a photo of it somewhere. I've been sent a photo of it. It's absolutely like, and everyone, of course, is absolutely howling with laughter. And I'm just like, mid-song, I'm just through the mic, just like, I kind of need that to play my part. Can someone throw that back to me? So yeah, every show he did that. And the stupid thing is, I didn't even learn my lesson to the last, I think it was like the last 2 days. I was like, you're not touching this. This is on its, literally its last little bits of hinge. It's on its last hinges right now. So, but yeah, so going back from the chaos of Lightyear on stage to then going to like the really tight, we kind of know what we're going to say. We know who's going to speak between the songs kind of thing. It was very one extreme to the other. It was both different, but it was both great at the same point.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess you kind of answered my next question, because Adam had pointed out earlier that Lightyear, maybe a little less unhinged now, but still having the unhinged energy. I was kind of curious, specifically opening for a band like Real Big Fish that probably drew some audience that maybe were maybe not aware of you, or maybe not, you wouldn't go to your show. And how you guys engaged with that audience, and what level of unhinged those shows were.
I think it's weird, because there was definitely a lot of people that went to that show to see Lightyear. There was no doubt about that.
Yeah, sure.
And it's just hilarious when you see these people who, like, you're popping their Lightyear cherry, and in mid song that you all of a sudden the Black Beauty theme comes on, and someone comes out as a panto horse, and a horse jockey like just walks across the stage. Like it's just, and everyone's just looking like, what the hell is going on? And then there'd be like these rain stick dancing that we'd be doing in the middle of it as well. It was, yeah, it was really, the only way I could describe a Lightyear show is it's a party. It's you're there, and it engages the audience in that way. So yeah, there was definitely a lot of new fans made from that tour. Definitely.
Can you explain the Black Beauty thing? What exactly
like
was
the,
that?
The theme from the movie Black Beauty comes on, and then the members of Lightyear are in a pantomime horse costume, and they come out on stage.
That would be me.
Yep.
so basically, you'd hear there's a song called Blindside, where it kind of stops in the middle, and it happens pretty much every single show. Something quirky happens, but then all of a sudden through the PA you hear this, and then basically Chaz would be dressed as a jockey and I would be there as a panto horse on hands and knees, just like galloping across the stage. And everyone's just kind of looking at it, just really like, why are you doing this? And there's no rhyme or reason to doing it. there's no reason to do it. Chaz just does it and Lightyear just do it because they can. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
If they want to stop mid-song and have a picnic for 10, 15 minutes, what are you going to do about it? Not a lot.
Yeah.
You paid £8 for that. What are you going to do about it? Not a lot. But yeah, it's just, I don't know, like there was a lot of people just feel, I don't know, there was a lot of people I think just concerned, felt like if someone spikes my drink, why is Black Beauty all of a sudden appeared on the thing and everyone's doing rain dancing? Yeah, it's just brilliant fun, man. It's just an absolute party.
We'll be right back after this.
I don't want to spend too much time on it, but Pook, were you at the show where they came out with the pantomime horse during Body Count?
Oh no, but I wish I was.
Aaron, have you heard about this?
No.
Oh my God.
Just we'll keep it short because I'd like to talk to them about it at some point. But they played a festival in Body. Go ahead. You go ahead, Pook.
So never dare, never ever dare Chaz and Neil to do anything because they'll fucking do it. And they won't just do it, they'll smother it. They'll won't just cross that line. They'll stampede over it. So someone dared them, I believe, to go on mid-Body Count set as the panto horse and just walk around on the stage. And apparently, like they got, oh God, I'm crying. They did it. And apparently they got chased off stage. They jumped on like a buggy and went to the other side of the festival and kind of hid for a bit. And this is like Reading and Leeds Festival. So then there's the second, this is on the first day. And the end of that, one of their bouncers or something went up to them and just said like, yeah, you better not do that again because Ice Cube's gonna have you shot. No,
Ice Tea.
Oh shit! Yeah, it's Ice Tea, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
That's NWA. My bad. So yeah, so Ice Tea's gonna basically have you shot, and they were like, "Oh, okay." They were like, "Yeah, if you do that again, oh, well, you just say if you do that again, you'll have us." Well, should we find out? So the next day. The next day, not as bad, they went into the Body Count dressing room. Now, all you can see on this horse mask is you can see through the nostrils. And all they could see, apparently, was this big security guy, like this massive guy, like his arms crossed. And all he heard was, Ice-T is not amused. And they just turned around and just left. They're just, oh, just don't probe them because they will retaliate. It was just genius, absolute genius.
So what year was this that this happened?
Oh, God.
Like,
I have no idea.
This was a while ago, yeah.
Yeah, this would have been 2000, and maybe 2006.
Okay.
But really on my bucket list is to talk to Lightyear about this. And then to eventually talk to Ice-T about it. Like, I really want to, I really want to talk to Ice-T and be like, do you remember playing Reading Leeds Festival and a pantomime horse came on stage and to see what he says?
Oh, it'd be so good. Can you imagine getting them on together?
Yeah. I think that's the real bucket list.
Yeah.
Most awkward conversation, but like, oh my man, like if you have to get Chaz on here because I'll give you a heads up, the stories though, if you're literally just wanting an episode of Lightyear stories, you'll buckle in, it'll be a long one.
Yeah,
but it will be the most entertaining one ever. It's manic, but they're just honestly though, like the biggest sweethearts. Like, love Chaz. Like, Chaz is now starting a music merch thing called Hawker, just like an online thing, which is going really, really well. So yeah, they're all working really, really hard, and hopefully it'd be great if they could do something like have a new release in them.
Yeah, speaking of working really hard, let's hear about your label.
Yeah, well, you're making it sound like I'm working really hard on it. It's the majority of it is my girlfriend Katie. She's she's like you know, like how the Fat Wreck thing where it's Erin does all the work, Mike takes all the credit. Mm. It feels a little bit like that at the all moment. Right. but yeah, I'll go with that. I'll roll with that. Yeah, it's been an interesting one, especially doing it during the pandemic. It was I'm trying to think when I started it. Like the Omnigon album, that came out in 2019, mm-hmm. right? Again, yeah. Wasn't it? Mm-hmm. That was really when it kind of first started, because I played trombone on that.
Yeah.
And I wanted to get the album. But looking at the cost of like postage and then customs charge, it was like, I love that album, Adam, but I ain't paying £60 for
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
It's
understandable.
Yeah. So I got talking, I can't remember how, I got talking to Mike at Bad Time about helping him get his releases over in the UK, because like Kill Lincoln, phenomenal band, and would smash it over here. Got talking to him, and then he was like, yeah, I'll tell you what, we'll arrange something where if I buy in bulk and like get a few of his releases all in one hit, and it would like, overall it'll make it a bit more affordable. So it all kind of really started from that, really. So it started off as a distro, and I really enjoy like the, I find it quite therapeutic in the sense of buying vinyl, like when you collect vinyl, I'm just like a huge vinyl geek. Like I've got loads of the stuff. So the way that I kind of saw it is that I was getting that bit of vinyl therapy of purchasing stuff, but I was kind of like covering my costs with it as well. Mm-hmm. So I kind of got to go from that, just starting off as a distro. And then we took on a few other labels as well. Like overseas, primarily just the overseas ones, where we thought like the bands deserve that kind of recognition. And then all of a sudden it just kind of branched out into a label. I think we wanted to, the Beat the Red Light, Salt the Lands anniversary was coming up, because that was coming for 10 years. And we'd always wanted to see a vinyl release off it. So we were like, right, okay. So Eddie and I did a split release on that, just to kind of like have a bit of a guinea pig run, I guess. And yeah, it just evolved and went from there, really. And it's been the response has been absolutely phenomenal.
What are some of the bands you've worked with as original releases, not distro?
Yeah, right. Okay, so we started. So the first one was the Beat the Red Light, Salt the Lands. The ones got the mo was the Andy B in the World.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've heard of that.
That's a great record.
What he pulled out of that, I literally didn't think was humanly possible.
That was the first record you did that was not a reissue and not a distro then?
Yeah. Yeah, that was it.
So tell me a little bit about how that came together. Did he reach out to you, or were you at kind of like saying, you know, like, hey, I'm looking for original records to release?
So he... I knew kind of Andy a little bit through his old band, Fandangle, and but not that well. I really kind of got to know him through actually the Real Big Fish tour, because he was guitar teching and doing photography on that tour throughout the whole thing. So I got to hang out with him a lot there. And he from that point, I kind of was checking out, like after that, I was watching his YouTube content, and he dropped a snippet of Frantic, which just completely blew me away. And not only that, what he'd explained, like on the videos, like what his plan was, what his vision was. And I was just like, I have to be involved with it.
Could you explain what that vision is? Because, yeah, we kind of brushed over that just so people, anyone that's not familiar.
So basically, it's called Andy B in the World. And basically, the reason why it's called that is he travels around the world. It's a bit harder, mostly with COVID, but with this first one, he traveled around the world with a studio and recorded 172 different musicians for each playing different parts for each song. So each song will have a completely different lineup to the next song. So you've got, wow, you've got, I think it's like 13, 14 tracks on there. So you'll have 13, 14 different singers, guitarists, horn players. There's even like a 50-part freaking harmony barbershop quartet shenanigans going on it on one bit. Like it's crazy what he's managed to pull out of the bag. And some of the people that he's got of it, so he's got like members of Rubik Fish, Less Than Jake, RX Bandits, Slackers, you name it, they've pretty much been they're pretty much been on there. So yeah, he's just managed to pull that out of the bag, and it's a phenomenal album. How he did that and didn't go bald, I don't know. It's just, I find it, like I said earlier, like getting an 8-piece band together is like herding kittens, trying to juggle 172 musicians.
Yeah,
is that's next level.
So he was already, he was working on it when you guys started discussing the release, or had he already finished it?
Yeah. He'd already, he'd recorded the vast majority of it. Then we arranged to put it out, that we were going to put it out. And then he asked me to do, so yeah, he was still doing bits and bobs. I put trombone down to a couple of tracks as well. It was just a phenomenal project to be involved with.
Yeah, no, I think that record's amazing. I agree with you. The songwriting's great, and the musicianship. There's certain songs where you can tell there's a lot of people on it, and it sounds great. Yeah.
Yeah. It's but every song, but they don't, it's weird. They all sound, they've got a familiar sound to it, but it's all got different styles to it as well. There's like a bit of hip hop in there, a bit of gypsy folk music. There's lots of different styles going in there. It's a phenomenal record. He absolutely knocked it out of the park. So yeah, that was definitely a great album to start off as a label on. Definitely.
I heard that he's working on a second record, and he intends to record on every continent, including Antarctica. Is that true?
Go big or go home, eh? Yeah. He's that's his plan. That's his plan. I mean, it hasn't, if it wasn't for lockdown and COVID still, I think he would have gone by now. I was going to be meeting up with him in Japan at some point this year, but I think it's all been pushed back a bit. But yeah, that's his plan, and I think he's still planning to go ahead with it. So yeah, it'll be a good one.
My question for him is: is he aware of an Antarctica ska band that he's going to meet up there, or is he bringing ska bands to Antarctica?
I think he's going there and then finding musicians.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if necessarily these are going to be all ska musicians, but it's going to be musicians that are going to play ska.
Yeah. All right.
We're going to introduce them to the world of ska, to the world of Ep.
I'm into it. So, who else have you worked with and have stuff coming out?
Oh, blimey. So we've literally dropped earlier this week. We're helping distro a band called Filthy Militia, which is a sort of pop punk reggae ska band.
Yeah, great band. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Phenomenal band. Phenomenal band. Lovely guys as well. So they've just dropped an EP. So we're helping them out with that. We're waiting for Glory Hunters, mm-hmm. who are a Russian ska core band. They may be familiar to a lot of people because they were on the Shape of Ska Punk to Come Volume 2. They were on that. So they'll sound familiar to a few people. Just an amazing band. It'd be awesome to try and get them to come over to the UK as well. Do a little tour and whatnot. Then there's Rashambo, which I gotta admit, I think that's a bit of an all-star band. So it's like ex-current members of do you guys know Faintest Idea?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
JB Conspiracy.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's got those guys, another band called The Junk. I don't know if you've heard of them. They were like an old ska core band, early noughties.
Not familiar with them now.
Definitely worth checking out. That was a bit of an all-star one. They're working on their album at the Mo. So and then we're literally just waiting for the Redeeming records, which are getting pressed as we speak, which is like, oh, that's a dream come true. Like that's been a long wait, that one. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'll be super stoked to get that one out.
How many songs are on that record, Pook?
I know where you're going with this. It's a five track mini album.
How long are the songs though, Pook?
About 19 minutes. nice, not that bad. I think the longest one is like 6 minutes. It's not that bad, Adam. Come on.
Aaron, Pook sent me one of these songs early on.
Yeah.
And he's like, check this out. This is the new band. And I listened to it and I was like, it's cool. But like there's like three songs mashed into one song. Like each one of these songs has like movements.
Hey, like I said, man, like you got to be taken on a journey.
Yeah, you get taken on a journey for sure.
Oh yeah.
It's like those black metal records where it's like 4 minutes of sort of building ambience and then it goes, it's like a ska break and then
that's it.
Then you go back down. Yeah.
It's 4 minutes between each chicken. Chicken. Yeah, no, I mean, I gotta be honest, I think that's why we kept it to like five tracks.
Yeah,
because of like that reached about, I think that was half an hour. So like for me, if we started to go like Salt the Lands, that was nine tracks. Yeah. And that was I think that was like 45-50 minutes, something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we got that press. So yeah, really, really looking forward to getting that one done, because that one was it was initially going to be a solo, because I started recording it in 2015, just after Beat the Red Light disbanded. And then it got to a certain point, it was just taking so long to get it done, and by that point we started Redeeming, and they were just like, look, let's just re-record this but as a whole band. Mm. I'm so glad that we did, because it just sounds so much better to have, like, instead of a jack of all trades trying to play it all, to have like a king of one just like doing it. It makes so much more sense, and it sounds so much better for it as well. Super stoked with how that's came out.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, waiting for vinyl, it's just so painful.
Oh yeah,
like it's been the vinyl industry at the moment is like waiting for, initially I think back in the day you were waiting for like 3 months, and now you're almost looking at nine months, like from sending the MP3s and the artwork to getting the test press and receiving the actual records, you're looking at the best part of over half a year, which is pretty, pretty painful.
Yeah. All these people who have been making, you know, illicit NFTs with, you know, cover art of bands without their consent. Maybe if they took some of this energy and put it into opening a record plant in the United States.
That'd be great. If they could do that, that would be great.
Yeah, anybody that can order, that can open a record plant at this point is going to be really, like, swamped with orders immediately.
God, yeah. Yeah, you'd be literally, yeah, business would be booming. It's, yeah, I mean, like, we've got the, in Wickham, we've got the pressing plant, Package Sounds, and they do our pressing there, as well as like a load of others. Like, I think they do like the S-Bam, Fat Rec, they it's all pressed over there.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, but it's crazy. Like, they I've gone in there and done some work for them, because I know some of the guys there, and Eddie works there as well. Like, Filaments Beat the Red Light, he works there as well, and they wanted me to have a look at one of the machines, and it's just like, it's so, those machines are huge and just so expensive. it's nuts. But it's like, you see them in the office, and like the backlog and whatnot, and it's just like, oh man, it's a long wait. But for me personally, it's my favorite format. So it's totally, totally worth it.
Thank you so much for listening to In Defense of Ska. If you've enjoyed this episode, please like and subscribe to the podcast wherever you normally stream or download episodes. If you haven't already, grab a copy of my book, In Defense of Ska, available at clashbooks.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. It's at In Defense of Ska. And please consider joining our Patreon at patreon.com/In Defense of Ska. You will get monthly bonus episodes, extended interviews and commentary per episode, and access to the In Defense of Ska Discord. In Defense of Ska would not be possible without the great team that tirelessly works on it every week. So you should go check out their other projects as well. Co-host Adam Davis has an amazing band called Omnigon. Give them a follow on Instagram and Twitter. It's simply @Omnigon. And our editor, Chris Reeves, has a phenomenal record label and podcast called Ska Punk International. For more information, go to skapunkinternational.com. And if you've ever enjoyed one of the highly specific In Defense of Ska memes floating around the interwebs, it was likely the work of The Bands I Like Only Charge $18. Find them on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And on that note, we leave you by saying, Ska now more than ever.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Save big money on everything for your next project at Menards. Spring is here, making it the perfect time for outdoor projects. Suncast storage sheds are an excellent solution for protecting outdoor lawn and gardening tools. They're easy to assemble, and the all-weather construction provides water resistance and UV protection. Save big on Suncast storage sheds. View our selection of Suncast products today in-store and on Menards.com. Save big.